What do you want from me?
I want to know why you would do such a thing. Sacrifice your future as well as this agency's for what?
You wouldn't understand.
Why not?
Because you're straight.
Still queer as folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show and find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Hit that subscribe button so you don't miss any of our episodes. And if you like our show, 5-star ratings and a review goes a long way.
And you can continue the discussion with us on all of the social media platforms at Still Queer AF, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This episode is called Poster May Lead to the Truth. It's episode number 11 of season 3. There's only 3 more to go this season.
Wow. This season's sort of flown by to me. Well, this one first aired in the U.S. on May 25th, 2003.
Poster May Lead to the Truth was directed by Chris Grismer, his first of 3 Queer as Folk episodes.
Oh, a new director.
He would later go on to direct 5 episodes of Kyle XY. We haven't talked about Kyle XY in a long time, and I still have not watched it. All I remember is that the main character is born without a belly button.
Yes, because I believe he is an alien of some sort.
Some sort, yes. Chris Grismer also directed 8 episodes of Designated Survivor, which is a show that I kind of like. Kiefer Sutherland plays the president in there after the entire government is blown up. He's the only one left. So he becomes the president. He's the Designated Survivor.
Yeah, because like they blow up the Capitol in some way.
And yeah.
He's the one who's like, oh, shit.
I actually like the show. It's kind of goofy. You have to suspend disbelief a lot in the show. Mm-hmm. And it's a far cry from the West Wing. They try to incorporate a lot of West Wing style into it, like a walk and talk and things like that. And it just doesn't work.
No, not if you don't have Sorkin doing it.
Yeah, but it's a fun show. It's nice, easy watching network TV.
Sounds like something my parents would watch.
Watch it when it rains.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Cowan and Lippman wrote the story, and Brad Fraser wrote the teleplay. This is his second Queer as Folk episode, and he would write 8 total and produce 12 episodes. Fraser is also the executive story editor for 14 episodes.
Here's what happened in Poster May Lead to the Truth from Queer as Folk, the book.
Justin and the gang crash Stockwell's speech at the Gay and Lesbian Center.
The mayoral candidate puts 2 and 2 together and finds Brian post-sex with the cause of many of the campaign's recent problems.
It was more like 3/4 sex.
Yeah, they were still going at it.
Oh, yeah. Brian is fired for the revelation.
Period. Ben and Michael open their home to the problematic Hunter.
Melanie and Lindsay ask Ted to manage Gus's college fund, but he only manages to use it for an impromptu trip to Palm Springs for the white party.
Attaboy.
That's terrible.
And Brian forcibly reopens the back room of Babylon.
Yeah, I have questions about that.
Poster May Lead to the Truth has an IMDb rating of 7.6. That's on the low end for this season, which I thought was interesting because this was not a terrible episode.
I think that's fascinating because the last couple of episodes have rated rather highly. And if I remember correctly, you weren't a huge fan of the last couple of episodes.
No, they were very schizophrenic. And I felt like the writing just got very fast and loose. There wasn't good separation of the stories. It was hard to track with what was going on. So that was a little surprising. Maybe people like the franchise of it all.
Mm.
So the A story in this episode is Brian and Justin versus everyone. No, just Stockwell.
It's usually versus everyone in some way.
Versus the world. What was this semi-truck orgy thing that was going on?
Yes, they're having...
Where can we find one of those?
But yeah, let's look at all of the issues that they're going through. So we know that all of the baths are closed, and so they have nowhere to go to have sex that's not in their house. So we know in the last episode, Justin managed to blow Brian, at least in an alleyway that had convenient alley lighting, you know, for camera work. Here, they go into basically a secret sex party that's being housed in the back of an 18-wheeler trailer.
Your cock is really hard.
I gotta try frozen solid.
Mm-hmm. You don't suppose my tongue will stick to it, do you?
Are you okay?
Metal's fucking freezing.
This sucks.
And not in a positive, life-affirming way.
There has to be someplace else we can go.
And it's very cold. And there's a secret knock to get in.
Yes. Was it the Feldman Bar Mitzvah?
Couldn't they have just gone to somebody's house? It's like, why do they have to find a truck in the middle of nowhere?
So many people have homes that they could go to that could host.
I mean, but at the minimum, they have garages.
Something where you could at least have a space heater. I mean, come on.
Yeah, this was like the Craigslist era where it's sort of the, I am open for business. The lights will be off. There will just be one small bulb over me. The door will be unlocked. Come in, do me, and leave.
Yes, there's a blindfold, totally anonymous.
And that's indoor. You don't have to go to the local truck depot and find like the needle in the haystack of the truck. How'd they find that right one, one anyway?
I think they figured it out because it had steps leading up to it. That, at least that was what I was figuring was going on. Because that was the only way they could get up to the level of the truck.
Yeah, I thought that whole thing was just kind of goofy.
Well, I'm glad they acknowledged that. Like Brian and Justin walked in there and like, they're bumping into a bunch of people. It's freezing in there. I'm glad that they were like, this is stupid.
Well, that's what I got to is it really that big of a thing to have sex in public?
I mean, have you had sex in public, Patrick?
Yes, but given the choice of in public or not in public, I would take either.
When it's like 12 degrees outside.
Yeah, I'm not going searching for it.
I'm gonna do it indoors. I like heat. Sorry. No, I can't. You can't focus if you're that cold. Everything just shrivels inside you.
So why not just go home and have sex then, which done. They did.
They go to Brian's bed. What a novel idea.
So this was this interesting was really just a dramatization to show that bad man Stockwell is shutting down Liberty Avenue and taking away their world.
Yes, it's basically forcing the gays to go underground or in
back
a trailer.
To Brian's loft. Yes. Which actually worked out well because there's a really nicely shot sex scene, that really nice, beautiful orange lighting.
Did you notice that it was sort of hazy around the frame?
They have a smoke machine.
Well, I'm saying,
they're like, okay, ready to go.
I know. I'm saying in the frame itself, it seemed to get a little blurry in a way. Mm-hmm. It almost give it a dreamlike quality. Yeah. And I noticed that in a few frames in the episode.
Grease the lens.
Vaseline. We got to remove some years from Brian.
Something interesting that I thought of when I was watching the sex scene is we always see Brian just pounding the hell out of Justin. And Brian always gets off, but we never see Justin get off. He's just a passive bottom that's getting pounded. There's never a moment where the bottom gets off first, or Justin gets off first. He never gets off.
I was going to say, Justin, we don't see necessarily getting off on his sex, but we do know that Brian has helped bottoms get off, including the one who came buckets on his table.
That's right. I forgot about him.
But there are definitely...
But poor Justin. Where's his bucket?
But there are some people who... exists in the world where their pleasure gets derived from seeing their partner get off.
I don't think Justin's one of them.
But I agree with what you just said.
He's a teenager. He's got to spray all over.
Yeah, I feel like we don't get to see Justin's pleasure unless he's being the top in the back room at Babylon.
Yeah, I just feel like these sex scenes could have been that much better if they were having mutual orgasms. Maybe that's what is happening and we're just missing it because Brian's so gymnastic while he's doing it.
Yeah. Yes.
Acrobatic.
Yeah, but like some flipping would have been nice.
Or to just have Justin say something like, yes. Oh, whoa. And then Brian like goes into his. But no, it's always about Brian. Justin, poor Justin. He's an untended for bottom.
Yes, this show makes it seem like in gay sex, only one partner can get off.
Yeah.
And that's most certainly not the case.
My rule is the bottom must get off first or within 90 seconds of the top.
That's a great metric.
How
well have you done?
I just asked Suri to start a timer for me.
All right, I'm off. I would ask Siri to do such a thing, but I worry that she will turn on.
Yeah, in the studio here, there's a Suri that's right outside the door, and occasionally she comes to life and starts speaking to us while we're recording.
Now playing podcast, Still Queer as Folk.
All right.
So the Gay and Lesbian Center with Stockwell, Justin staged a pretty decent protest there.
Oh, I thought it was fantastic.
Margarita Lopez. Excuse me?
Margarita Lopez was transsexual. She was murdered 5 years ago. Her killers have never been found.
The Pittsburgh PD does its best to solve every crime.
I thought that it was a great protest, and I thought the scene was really powerful, but for some reason, I also thought that it's a bit of a stretch to pin all of this on Stockwell.
Well, he is the representative. I mean, he is the police chief, and now he's running for an office. So who better to hold accountable for his department than the chief? I mean, the police have to answer to him. And I think you're right. I think this was a protest that was done very effectively. I appreciated that it was a protest that showed how a peaceful one can go. And that they were essentially, until the advisors finally spoke up and said, we're wrapping this up, that Stockwell just had to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great.
Good timing.
It was really excellent. And I like that they also specified each victim in a way that I feel speaks to today. The fact that the first victim, I think some of the vocabulary is a little off. I mean, to say that the first victim was a transsexual I feel like that's a dated.
Yeah. Adjectives change over time.
What really got me was when Jennifer Taylor stood up.
Justin Taylor, my beautiful gay son, attacked at his prom, left for dead. Police reported it as a simple assault instead of a hate crime, which it was. His attacker got off with community service.
And I will freely admit that when Jennifer Taylor stood up and said, my beautiful gay son, I got so choked up in that moment.
Uh-huh.
And
for me, it was Debbie, though, with the Jason Kemp poster.
Yes, the fact that it was a 1-2 punch. But yeah, like
because Jennifer Jason Kemp died.
Right. And that led to such egg on Stockwell's face that because you could see he was trying to spin it in a way that he's like, oh.
Well, this was something that I wasn't sure about because he said that he remembered him. And I was thinking, oh, I wonder why he remembers that murder. We don't know yet. We don't find out for many more episodes. So this was some really advanced foreshadowing that you would really only pick up on if you were rewatching the show.
That's an excellent point. And I think that's what's so great about how Debbie is able to nail Stockwell to the wall, at least for this crowd. Remember, the Gay and Lesbian Center has been trying to show that they support Stockwell and how he's trying to make Liberty Avenue family friendly, which is so strange. But I mean, I think we see something very similar in Chicago and Boys Town, where we're used to seeing so many bars that go up and down Halsted. But if you go to the very beginning of Halsted, you see a childcare center.
This reminds me of something. I used to live in that neighborhood and I moved north along with the gay community over time.
Yes.
But there is this big, we'll call it a sex toy store. It was called Batteries Not Included, that was huge. And just about any toy that you could imagine, you could find there. And it was a great little locally owned business. They're super friendly and super open to anything that you would ask them, like, I'm kind of looking for a prostate tickler. Yes. And they were like super happy and super friendly people. At the time, the area was gentrifying a whole lot. And the stroller set that was walking their children. Is that what you call it when you take the child out in the stroller? It's like walking the dog, you walk the child.
I mean, people are putting their children on leashes, so that's might true. As well. Yes.
They started to get uncomfortable with the window displays of Batteries Not Included. And so there was this big uproar of, they have to stop doing that. No dildos in the window. And this was a neglected gay area when the LGBTQ population was colonizing it in the 70s and 80s and built it up into something that basically, very few LGBTQ people can afford to live in these days.
Absolutely.
That was just a nice reminder when I was watching this episode when the guy in the suit and tie stands up and says, my townhouse was broken into and it took the police 2 hours to come. It's like, honey, 2 hours? You're lucky they showed up. Normally, you'd be able to get the report over the phone. You're broken into? Okay. What time? All right. Okay. Got it. It's like a lot of people think that the police show up and take fingerprints and like send it to the lab. There's no lab.
They think every crime is done with CSI.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's kind of why I thought that it was a little bit of a stretch to put Jason Kemp's murder and the murders and stabbings of all the other people on Stockwell. Most murders in the US and major cities anyway are not investigated. If there is a lead that immediately comes about, yes, they'll follow it up. But for the most part, no.
But I think this was a part of Justin's protest is that there are so many crimes specifically against the LGBTQ community that are being dismissed or left unsolved. So how can you support a candidate who makes it seem like here are all these examples? And this is what we get into later on, is that we have all these examples of people in the community who have been murdered and forgotten.
Yeah, I just wish that we had more to pin on Stockwell at this moment. Right now, we have this vague notion that he's a homophobe only because people are saying it. We haven't actually seen so much these actions. He didn't close down the bar like his henchmen did. He didn't find Jason Kemp. Carl did. And so Stockwell's direct involvement in this was not existent. And I think this scene would have been much more powerful if they had cornered him on all of these things. But he's just kind of this archetype that represents all of the police. You know, it's like Melanie is lawyer, Ted is accountant, and Stockwell is police. I just wish the story would have put more of the onus of these crimes onto Stockwell. Like, he was there. He didn't do anything about it. There's a lot that we had to just kind of accept and take for granted.
I guess I see what you're saying. But because he has to be the face of the police.
Yeah, he's definitely an archetype.
That's why.
The lightning rod.
He's the one who is there to answer for it. Even if he wasn't the one, say, you know, Horvath was the one. He was the one there when they found Jason Kemp.
Right.
But Horvath isn't running for mayor.
So the conflicted look on Brian's face was interesting as Stockwell was leaving. I couldn't tell if he was glad to see Stockwell on the ropes or if he's worried that his job was at risk. I wasn't sure where his head was at there.
I think that's tied to the fact that we know that the only reason why Justin found out about all of these unsolved crimes, I'm assuming, was from Brian.
How would Brian know about them all?
I mean, he's been this close to Stockwell. I mean, this is my understanding.
Oh, well, I guess it wouldn't be secret. They'd be in the paper and things like that.
There's that. But the fact that, at least what I was perceiving in the moment, was that somehow Brian was the one who was working from the inside of the campaign to help Justin along. Because they mentioned that in the diner.
Yeah, I think that's a thin thread.
I'm absolutely agreeing with you, but there's a perception, I feel like they're trying to show that Brian is the one who is feeding Justin the information and giving him the hints, like, maybe you should go to the gay and lesbian center and maybe you should do this, that, or the other, if that makes any sense.
I did like how Stockwell gave Justin this once over as he was walking out of the venue. He definitely recognized him, but it was a nice, subtle move where we weren't sure if he was connecting all the dots at that moment. He saw him, he recognized him, wasn't quite sure why. And that was a little bit of dramatic tension that built up because we see him look at him and then we're like, uh-oh.
I mean, I would assume that he was a detective at one point before he became the police chief.
Yep. There is something I bumped on too is in the bar later where they're celebrating. The minors, Justin and Daphne, are drinking beer with the adults. They're including Justin's mother. I just thought that was a little funny. The show plays really fast and loose with the drinking age.
At this point, they're like, you know, Justin's been coming here since he was 17. Why not?
My parents would never let me drink like underage in front of them in public.
My parents still get weird whenever I get a drink now and I'm 30. Like,
it's like, it's like, Matt, it's like 8 a.m. I know, but.
But this orange juice needs a little champagne.
Just needs a little kick.
That's all.
I thought you were going to say vodka.
Oh, I can't do screwdrivers. No, thank you.
I like these scenes where Debbie lectures Brian, and we got one in this episode.
You don't seem too upset.
About what?
Oh, he just exposed your boy's considerable shortcomings in full view of the press.
Well, every politician has to deal with a lunatic fringe.
You know, in the old days, before you sold your soul for a sack of gold, you'd have been the one who laid the trap for Stockwell. In fact, it had the hand of the master written all over it. I guess those days are gone.
She's often used as Brian's conscience when Brian's doing crazy shit.
And this is where I thought she may have had a hint of, I wonder where Justin got all this information.
Mm-hmm.
Because normally this would be something that a Brian Kinney would do.
True.
And I like that. I like that she was a detective all herself for that moment.
I did like that Brian referenced the movie Norma Rae when he was talking about Debbie holding up the sign, because I love that movie.
And that's an iconic thing. I mean, everyone knows that moment when Sally Field is holding that sign in the factory.
There's a piece of sideways trivia here. Blair Fell, who we interviewed in season 2, he was a writer for Queer as Folk. He wrote an acceptance speech for Sally Field, who played Norma Rae in that movie.
And won an Oscar for it.
That's a great piece of trivia.
But I don't think he wrote her Oscar speech, nor her famous one, "You Like Me, You Really Like Me."
No, he's probably a little boy then.
Yes.
I thought it was strange, though, that Stockwell and Gardner Vance met up at the Vanguard office.
Thanks for meeting me at this hour.
You said you needed to speak to me personally and confidentially.
That's right. I've become aware of the situation within my campaign, that there's someone I worked with closely, someone I've trusted, who's working against me.
That's very unfortunate. But what are you telling me?
It's Kinney.
We get a rare second fuck scene in this episode. Normally they fuck once per episode. It's overlaid with Stockwell and Gardner talking. And one real quick aside here, I hadn't done an underwear check in quite a while, but I just wanted to point out that both Brian and Justin were wearing black trunks.
Maybe they're sharing underwear now.
Well, I wish they were wearing briefs, but... Okay.
I'm much more of a trunk person than a brief person.
So improbably, Gardner and Stockwell decide to just pop in at Brian's loft. Hey, let's go to Brian's house.
I have to tell you, I was cackling when Brian opened the door.
Oh, it was funny as hell, but...
And
why did they go there? You don't do that.
Well, and it proves to my point that, you know what would be really great for this building that Brian lives in?
A doorman?
Maybe a... Even a buzzer.
Yeah.
Even a buzzer.
We know he has a buzzer because he buzzes people in all the time. He buzzes his tricks in.
But these people just so happen to show up.
Yeah, they get all the way upstairs.
They get to his door. Like, you know what? Even a peephole, something. To give him like a little warning that he could maneuver his way out of
this. I do like that he just whips the door open all the time, even when he's
completely naked.
Yeah.
Completely naked.
Why wouldn't they just call first or just confront him at the office the next day? Why did they have to immediately like head over there?
It's probably a Stockwell thing because, as they said, the polls show that it's a very tight race and he just got his ass whooped at the Gay and Lesbian Center.
Well, make no mistake. I like the scene and I like the way it played out.
It makes no logical sense. It makes no logical sense. It's all done for drama, and drama that doesn't quite flow into the moment.
I love the reveal when Stockwell just pushes in to see the aftermath of Justin and Brian rolling around naked.
Yeah. Haven't you ever seen two men fuck?
Love right it. Away, Brian knew that this was going to be really bad. I like that look on his face.
But isn't that some sort of like, I don't want to say breaking and entering. It's like the way Stockwell sort of just barged his way in. I was like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he pushed in.
Yeah, I was like, you were not invited in and he is not committing any crime.
Right. I wish that Stockwell would have been a bit more pissed off though and just like shoved him or something or fought or like chased Justin around the loft naked.
Yes, or something to show that Stockwell's gone off the deep end.
Though I did like that it was a very measured response from Stockwell. He just took the poster of himself, crumpled it all up, and just kind of went at Brian with it. So it was one of those less is more moments. And I thought David Giannopoulos, who plays Chief Stockwell, did an excellent job in this scene.
Well, and Stockwell knows that he has Brian. He's got him by the balls, so to speak, because we see that even, and I also want to mention that I really appreciated watching Gardner Vance try to stand up for Brian and really defend him, saying it doesn't make any sense why he would sabotage your campaign. And I don't buy it. And I don't really know. You put me in a difficult position. And he was trying to do everything he could to save Brian.
The next day.
Yes.
Yeah. Really, he was doing that a little bit with Stockwell too, when the night before. And I like the way that it was cutting back and forth between like the good and the bad. I thought that went off the rails a little bit though, because Brian tells Gardner that he wouldn't understand why he was colluding with Justin against Stockwell.
What do you want from me?
I want to know why you would do such a thing. Sacrifice your future as well as this agency's for what?
You wouldn't understand.
Why not?
Because you're straight.
Whatever the reason, you just fucked yourself out of a job.
But Brian had no problem running Stockwell's campaign all this time, so his answer was pretty shallow there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's like, because you're straight. It's like, well, Brian, you've been doing this for like the past five, six episodes of running this campaign of this terrible person who is railing against the LGBTQ community, and you only care now because you don't have a bathhouse to go and fuck anonymous dudes?
Yeah, like, it just didn't come across as this altruistic mantra about being a gay man.
Yeah,
it's sort of like
I think it's, I think shell is a great way to put it, sort of a weak reason to hide behind why he did it.
So Gardner isn't having it and promptly fires Brian.
He is indeed fired
and escorted out of the building. There was something about this firing that was kind of weird, is Brian's a partner in this agency. He loses his income as a result of getting fired, but you can't fire a partner. You have to buy them out.
The way Gardner Vance took over this ad agency, I mean,
well, he can definitely fire him, but he can't like take his shares of the business.
Yes, he was trying to explain the complexity of how it works because he's a partner, but I think for the sake of time, they're like, but Gardner Vance is the majority shareholder and CEO, so bye.
Yeah, get the fuck out. I mean, it honestly, in episodic television, you sort of have to compress it into these moments. But I look for the details in these stories, and this was just kind of lacking something. It's like, why didn't Melanie come into play and practice
law?
Right. Debbie comes into play, comes to the rescue to console Brian. I thought that Debbie strangely lumped Brian into Justin's propaganda campaign.
I was escorted out of my office and off the premises by a security guard, without so much as a ballpoint pen.
That I'd like to have seen.
Why, so you could tell me I had it coming?
Damn right you did. What you and Sunshine were up to was treacherous and deceitful, and I've never been so fucking proud of you in my life.
Brian was only barely involved with it, just at the tail end of the last episode. So Debbie's comments about what you and Sunshine were up to didn't make a whole lot of sense. They weren't up to much together. Justin was up to it alone.
I think she's only working in the prospect of what she was able to clearly see. So she was sort of, I think you're right, lumping all the actions together as if they were in cahoots the entire time. But it's like,
Brian, well, that got me thinking. It's like, what did Brian get fired for? Why can't Brian just say, hey, not me, it's this kid?
Right, take it out on the intern.
How did Brian get like lumped into that? Throw Justin under the bus. Keep your job. Keep your shares in the company.
And I think
Brian put up one poster.
And I think he was trying to do that a little bit. It's like, okay, so yeah, I fucked the intern. Big fucking deal. But I think Stockwell was able to latch on that Brian had more of a hand or was not doing anything to discourage Justin.
Yeah, well, it was positioned as he had a hand in the Gay and Lesbian Center event, even though he didn't. But Stockwell kind of pinned all these things on him with circumstantial evidence. And I think that was enough to convict Brian.
Which sounds
good. I just wish it would have been stronger. Like, we just saw Brian being more underhanded about it, where he's more directly trying to get Stockwell to lose while at the same time trying to take his money, at the same time try to meet all of his contacts.
Try to screw him two or three different ways.
Yeah, basically all he did was he fucked Justin on top of a Stockwell poster.
The end.
Next.
I will say though, I did find this scene rather lovely between
when Brian Debbie got Debbie, high.
When Debbie got high. Mainly because I felt like I was watching Debbie be a mother to him, but not mothering him, if that makes sense. I felt like she was being comforting. She was listening and she was just accepting what Brian's role was in this. She didn't lecture him. She didn't lord over him in any way. She got to be there for him. And that's something that clearly his own mother has never done.
There was a great look on Debbie's face when she took that first hit off that joint. We're going to have to make a GIF out of that one because she, you know, has it pinched. She brings it up to her mouth. She's inhaling it. And all of a sudden her eyes go like saucer plate wide. And she's like, what the fuck did is this?
She said she hadn't gotten high since James Taylor had hair.
Yeah.
I love that line so much.
I did like the way that this was shot. As they got more and more stoned, the camera became more and more shaky. And it became handheld and was just kind of like swooping around in extreme close-ups.
And it had that fuzziness in the frame again.
Yeah, so it's a nice touch.
I don't know if that's a directorial style.
It was a new director. So yeah. It was great to see Chris Grismer actually do something new on the show.
Absolutely, yes.
After all this, Brian decides it's time to open the back room with the sledgehammer.
Yes, where did he get the permission to do such a thing?
He's so enraged. But I thought this was a nice bookend on the episode. It starts out trying to fuck in a trailer and ends up fucking in the back room again. So it's sort of like back to normal. It was hokey, but the metaphor was kind of nice. This lock breaks off, confetti falls out of the sky, shirts come off, it's open.
I need to know how Brian managed to get in past the doorman with a sledgehammer. Unless he and the owners have worked out like, I'm going to make this giant symbolic gesture. Just go with me on it. Also, can I borrow a sledgehammer? Like, what? Yeah.
That's a very good point.
Why is it that Brian got to decide that the back room was going to be open again?
Yeah, right.
What?
Well, he's sort of the reigning prince of it. I mean, Justin is still the king of Babylon. Mm-hmm. So there is a nice outro song here. It's by Low Fidelity All-Stars. It's called Battle Flag. And there's a lyric here that I wanted to read to you. Your construction smells of corruption. I manipulate to recreate this error to ground saga. Gotta launder my karma. That fits right into why he's opening the back room.
Yeah, this sounds like he is ready to join the fight against Stockholm.
And in the chorus, the Low Fidelity All-Stars are saying, on your motherfucking knees. I like that song.
A lot of people on their motherfucking knees in the back room of Babylon.
Still queer as folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes if you like those 5 stars.
It's still queer as folk. There's more on the way. So we have a question from a listener today. Let's go ahead and listen to it real quick.
Hey guys, this is Cameron from Northern California. I'm just curious what the differences are between the UK and the US versions of the Brian character are, and which one you guys like the best.
So thanks for your question. Brian Kinney and Stuart Alan Jones. I know the UK series very well, and you, Matt, know probably the US series very well. Yes. So this might be a little bit of point, counterpoint.
We should have 2 chairs and a little coffee table. Go back and forth.
So I would say that Brian is the hotter of the two. If you look at Brian and Stuart Alan Jones, would you agree?
Yeah, Stuart Alan Jones looks a little too much like Joel Osteen. And I think that's weird.
I thought that Stuart had this nice posh British feel to him that a lot of Americans don't really get. Americans look at him and cringe, and I grew up in England for part of my life, and so I find him as sexy as hell.
Okay.
They were both advertising executives, but we see Brian do more like ad man shit than Stuart ever does.
Stuart sort of just had the title.
I thought Stuart seemed better at it, though, than Brian. Whenever Brian's doing ad man shit, he often just comes across as like really fake. Almost like a non-ad man wrote the lines for the ad man without doing his research.
Yes, watching this show post-Mad Men.
Yeah.
We're calling bullshit on all the ad talk.
Comparing the two characters, to me it seemed less like Stuart was a Superman gay and just sort of a regular bloke that was charming, seductive, not like over-the-top good looks, but not in the gutter looks?
It seems, based on the things I've seen of Stewart, is that he put in the work to get the ass he got.
He did. It wasn't automatic. Brian is mostly written and played off as if he's God's gift to Gatum.
Which, and to me, I've always found Brian a little bland. I think he reads so close to his every gay man that I'm shocked at how many people think about him as the Brian Kenny.
I shudder all the time when there's writing in the US version where the characters are just praising Brian as if he's the end all be all of gay men. He's just not, though. And we just sort of have to take the writing team's word at it in order to kind of get through the story. So it's almost like, Brian, you're not all that. You're okay. There's things about you we like, but you don't need all your best friends telling us how awesome you are. That never really happened much in the UK series. A lot of, like most British things, a lot of it was just unsaid. There's something interesting about the original UK show is that Stuart, Vince, and Nathan, that's the Brian, Michael, and Justin characters. In the UK, they're really more kind of amalgamations of lots of different gay men. The series was really short. It was only 10 episodes. So the characters were kind of big tent representations of many different scenes, styles, types of guys. In the US versions, the characters lasted 83 episodes, so they tended to be very wide and much more nuanced. And so that's why I think Brian wins out on that one. Brian is a very nuanced character. We know a lot about him. Stuart Alan Jones ends up being somewhat mysterious because he doesn't have the benefit of 83 episodes to get to know him and see him go through many different things.
And that's also a tribute to the way British television is formatted.
Because true. Yeah.
Most series don't go on for as long as US television.
Definitely not. In terms of the actors, putting Gail Harold against Aidan Gillen, I got to say that Aidan Gillen is the better actor. Gail Harold, we really didn't see much of him after Queer as Folk. He was the lead in the show Vanished, but they killed him off after 8 episodes and replaced him with somebody else. He did 15 episodes of Desperate Housewives, did a great job in that. 9 episodes of Hellcats and 21 episodes of The Secret Circle. And he just does all these walk-on things. I think I told you a while ago that he popped up on Law & Order SVU as a crazy doctor.
He also popped up on Grey's Anatomy as a former Nazi.
Yeah, so he's like a walk-on bit player. That's kind of his sweet spot. Aidan Gillen has been on Game of Thrones for 6 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Listeners, I have not actually watched Game of Thrones.
He is awesome in that show.
Okay.
He was also on Peaky Blinders and did 35 episodes of The Wire. So those are like some major cable TV shows. Especially Game of Thrones.
Yeah, that's I think what they call a phenomenon.
And most recently, Aidan Gillen played John Reed, who was Queen's manager in Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh.
Yeah, so he's popping up everywhere.
I have yet to see Bohemian Rhapsody, so.
It just seems rare to encounter Gail Harold these days on TV.
And that may be his choice. Maybe he's tried to step away a little bit from acting.
So that's why I have to give the win in terms of acting to Aidan Gillen. So I'm a little biased because I always loved the UK series. It spoke to me a lot more than the US series. So I'm on the Stuart Alan Jones side for the win.
Okay.
What side are you on?
Well, I could only go on the Brian Kenny side because that's the only thing that I know. But now you've made me very interested in going back and reviewing the British series, because now I'm curious that because they had such a more definite end, if the storyline is much clearer for the characters than it is in the US version.
Well, definitely the ending of the UK version was shite.
Oh.
Did not like it at all. I'll do a little giveaway here. It's the Jeep turns into this magic floating time machine and it has a happy ending. And Nathan takes over as the new Stuart Alan Jones character on Canal Street in Manchester.
But you're coming back, though.
What? Come back to this. The ghetto. Alleyways stinking of hiss. Beggars in every doorway. Straights and students coming down to look at the freak show. And all the idiots saving all week, saving their stupid money from their stupid idiot jobs so they can come and shoot their load with some stranger. Just you look after it. This stupid little street. It's the middle of the world.
Yeah, it's a lot of people looked at that ending and went, ooh. Not surprising that the writer of the UK show, Russell T. Davies, went on to write Doctor Who for the next decade. So that ending of Queer as Folk fits right into that.
Maybe Queer as Folk is just part of that same universe.
So thanks for your question. If you have a question for us that you'd like us to talk about on the air, you can reach out to us at stillqueerasfolk.com/hello. You can leave a voicemail there or a written question if you want to appear on the show.
Still Queer as Folk.
So the first runner we're going to start with is the hunt for Hunter.
Hunter.
In which Michael and Ben are still trying to find Hunter somewhere on the street. This leads them to the diner. And because Debbie is the omnipresent character of the show, of course she knows where the hustlers have had to move.
It's a tell Debbie moment.
So she knows exactly where the hustlers have moved because... The
warehouse district.
Yes, the warehouse district. Thanks to the fact that, you know, it's early morning, so that's where all the hustlers go. Of course they go to the diner on Liberty Avenue.
Did you think that it was weird that they all, like, go and eat there? It's like, how many are there?
Apparently a lot, because it was very busy.
Yeah. And we talked about this in the last episode, but that just doesn't happen anymore. There are not gay hustlers roaming the streets saying, you like young dick?
You know, you want
There's apps me? For that.
You want to warm me up?
Yeah. You can suck it for a bill.
For two, you can fuck me without a condom.
So I thought it was funny that Ben and Michael are just wandering around the city looking for them.
Yes. And
when in fact, Debbie knows where they are the whole time.
Yeah. Go to the warehouse district. It's like, great. Thank you.
There Michael, he is. Ask your mother.
He should have known by now that Debbie would be the one who would know.
Yeah. So they go wandering over to the warehouse district, which I'm guessing is the same place that this semi truck party was at.
Agree. And I would have loved to have seen, like, if you see in the background, you see Justin and Brian walking towards the trailer truck. I would have loved that.
And then Michael and Ben have this moment of, are they looking for hookers? So predictably, Ben comes back later that night to find Hunter after he ditched Michael at the bar.
Right.
So what's going through Ben's head here? Let me get rid of my boyfriend so that I can go back to the warehouse district with a really ugly coat and find Hunter and give it to him.
To make sure he's warm.
Oh, coats and condoms, not just the coat.
Yes. I like the fact that he was trying to say you need to at least put on the condoms too.
I like that he gave them to him in a box.
I mean, he figured he's probably seeing a few clients tonight. So let's make sure he's well stocked.
Something about Hunter and all these scenes that I think is missing is that I think Hunter should have been smoking in all of these scenes where we see him out on the street. He never is.
Why do you want him to be a smoker?
I want him to be a little more edgy. Right now, he just kind of looks like a dirty little boy. Whereas we need to see more edge, more danger to him. It's like, oh, he's a 15, 16?
Yes, 16.
And he's smoking.
Well, he's also having unprotected sex with a lot of anonymous strangers.
I think it would have looked better, too. Like, there's all these nicely backlit scenes.
And you don't want the smoke coming from the cold air. You want it to come from a cigarette.
Yeah, he just needs to.
With the lit cigarette in the darkness. Yeah. Okay. You want a little more noir, I think.
Yeah. Yes. And I just kind of want him to just look a little more street kid. He didn't look street kid enough to me. And I don't know. I just thought it would have been a nice prop touch for him to always have a cigarette.
A detail. Okay. As much as Ben wants to try and save this kid, Hunter is very resistant.
Here's something that was unexplained too is all of a sudden he's back in the apartment with Ben. How did Ben lure him home? What was that initial like come back to my house moment? Because we see Hunter saying, get the fuck away from me because Ben is obviously disrupting his business.
And giving him an ugly ass coat. I like to say that people won't pick up guys that look like Eskimos.
And then they're eating miso soup. In the apartment. It's like, how did he lure him home?
It's like, I'll give you $20 if you just come back home with me.
What? Yeah. I gave you a coat. I gave you condoms. Would you at least come home with me? There was a mistake here, though. I don't know if you picked up on it, where Ben is telling Hunter that he's been positive for 3 years.
So, how long have you had it?
Why tested positive 3 years ago.
But we know that Ben's been positive for five years.
So how long you been positive, Ben?
Mother.
I'd just like to know.
That's okay. I'm fine with it. 5 years.
Oops.
Yes.
I mean, that's a major like fuck up in the story editor here. That's the whole bean around Ben.
Yes.
So, okay. Maybe that was more like the ounces and grams that Debbie did when she was weighing out her tuna fish. But here, this was like an important one.
It's an important one because like that, it helps explain like his steroid use.
Yeah. It explains a lot.
It explains so much.
That we just invested ourselves. About it.
It wasn't just an arbitrary number.
Exactly. So Michael does another U-turn on Hunter, which I thought was a little odd because the last episode he was much more compassionate after he found out that Hunter was positive. And here he kind of went back into that, get this kid out of our life. And I just thought that was weird.
I can't.
He's flip-flopping too much.
Yeah, I can't really stand Michael. He's so aggressively needy about himself.
Mm.
And I can't really take much more of it. Because at least with Ben, I have a clear understanding of his wants and why he needs to continue to take care of Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Because they share that positive status, which I love what Ben says when he says, we're related by blood.
Yeah, that was pretty deep coming from these writers. And
I was like, that is, I don't want to give the show too much credit by saying profound, but
it was.
It landed very strongly.
Yeah.
And it was such a simple idea.
It was enough to kick Michael in the face and say, hey, wake up, kid. Michael's Cro-Magnon spoon grip is back at breakfast, and Ben actually thought that Hunter was going to go to school that morning. I was like, oh, Professor Ben.
You should know
better
than
that. You are so
naive.
It seems like Michael was trying to tell Hunter to never come back.
Before you go on your merry way, I need to ask you something. Not for myself, but for Ben. I want to know if you're coming back. I don't think you are, but Ben thinks otherwise. I guess you could say he has more faith in humanity, or at least in you, than I do. Anyway, I would hate to see him get hurt, so if you don't plan on returning, just say so now, and I'll tell him not to expect you.
All I asked was for him to say he was my uncle. I never asked for the free meal, the bed, the coat. I sure as hell didn't ask to hear I'm positive, so he can keep his fucking help.
I'll let him know.
I don't think he was necessarily saying that, but I think he was trying to spare Ben's feelings in that he was telling Hunter, don't make a promise you can't keep.
Yeah, I kind of saw it as, you're not coming back, right?
Oh.
I won't see you again, right? You know, sort of that, I'm asking like a
I'm giving nice you a sweet, very strong suggestion.
Yeah, yeah. Mysteriously, Hunter makes it back home just at the stroke of midnight, so.
Yeah, he said midnight, right?
Yeah, he's there with 30 seconds to spare. I kind of like that. I like the little bit of tension building up. They're in bed. Mm-hmm. They're settling in for a long winter's nap, and there's the knock on the door. Again, no doorman, no buzzer. Front door's wide open. Well, yep. Come on up.
All Hunter had to do was knock.
Still queer as folk.
There was a Dyke brunch that I really liked in this episode.
That leads into poor Ted.
Yeah, I wrote that too. I was like, oh, Ted. A couple of funny things in the script that I picked up here is Emmett is doing two events a week. That's a lot for a party planner. There's that many parties and events that he's doing two a week.
There are that many Pittsburgh society folks that have heard of Emmett's extraordinary event planning skills that they have to have a party two a week. I can't tell if he has a staff. So
he's got Vic because Vic's like the chef.
Oh, okay.
It's just the two of them. Something I didn't like, we comment on the props a lot in this show, and there's a prop moment here that I did not like, and that's Mel and Lindsay serve syrup out of the plastic squeeze bottle.
You would expect them to have some sort of serving dish.
Exactly. I didn't like that moment because that was the only serving out of the container in that entire brunch. Everything else was in glass and china except the syrup. I didn't like that.
Okay.
I really bumped on that.
Now that I'm thinking about it, sure. Yes, I can see how you couldn't splurge for this either.
I thought it was a little weird that Melanie and Lindsay were throwing a lifeline to Ted. It's like with that investment, were they actually going to pay him to do that? Or was it like, here's something to do?
I feel like it was the latter. And Ted points that out too, is because he knew that Emmett and Mel and Lindsay were sort of in collusion.
Yeah, I just thought the story was a little like we've talked about a lot in this episode, just kind of fast and loose.
Yes. Let's say that they're giving Ted a purpose. That's that.
Those tweakers on the street, though, woo, did they look scary? That was like the Lost Boys coming down the street.
I described that. That doc is tweaking.
Yeah.
I mean, he is like sniffing and like, he can't handle himself. It's like, yeah, they closed the back room, so we're going to go back to my place and fuck.
Yeah.
Wow. He seemed really tweaked out. How do you know him anyway?
Oh, he's a ear, nose, and throat specialist. I went to him once to have my sinuses drained.
I've seen those types in Boys Town before, and a friend of mine worked the brunch at a Boys Town restaurant, and he hated that shift, that Sunday morning shift, because people were coming in after being up and out all night. They were still drunk. They were still drinking the bottomless mimosas.
It's like you want to get a spray bottle, like, down, boy, down. Yeah.
Mark the Devil messages Ted, and then Ted wants to go out with everyone at first, though. So he gets the message, and he's like, hey, let's go out. Let's go out. Let's go out. Why wouldn't he just sneak out? Which he eventually did. So I didn't understand that moment of him trying to get everybody to go out with him for a drink.
It's like he's trying to be a little less inconspicuous for what he really wants to do.
Which is go to the devil's house and hit that meth pipe. Ooh, that got... Ooh. That's such a disgusting scene that he's falling
into.
It
was awful to look at. And I think the show is doing a great job in showing how seedy that is.
Yeah.
You know, and as they go and he's getting high, they sort of add this golden light filter to everything.
Yeah, that's the meth light.
Yes, the meth light. And yeah, this is only a few years after Requiem for a Dream.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Which was a horrific film about addiction.
Oh my God, I forgot about that movie.
I think a lot of people try to, but you can't.
Yeah.
Once you see it, you can't unsee it. The fact that this ENT doctor, continues to tempt Ted into showing that his worth exists in the drugs that he does. And I have so many questions about this doc that I am shocked that this guy is ever lucid enough to actually see patients.
Well, we never quite see him doing as much as the people around him do. He's like one of those people that just takes a touch and then...
Yes, and he's usually like... Because he was smoking.
Yeah, he's...
In his den.
He's like one of those people that's doing all these things, but it's never addicted to it. Like the guy that literally will go out and just have one cigarette. Never gets addicted.
He looks like he's addicted.
That's true.
Well, you meet him on the street in daylight and he's just like twitching and like ready to party more. It's like... Ew.
One problem I had with this story arc is Emmett's turning into a wreck... Over Ted having gone missing after stepping out for a drink. Did you think it was weird that Emmett immediately started to cover for him, though?
It's a little like how Michael was covering for Ben during his steroid use. Because again, this series loves to just recycle storylines. So if Ted is having issues...
But in this case, he didn't cover it with Michael. He was on the phone with Michael telling Michael, I don't know where he is. I don't know what's going on. I'm afraid that something happened to him. But Melanie and Lindsay are some of their closest friends, so why wouldn't he have been just as honest with them as he was with Michael?
That's actually a very good question. Why is he trying to save face?
Yeah, why those two? It was almost like the story was out of order a little bit.
Oh, you know, maybe it's because, again, this is me reaching. Maybe it's because he didn't want them to worry about the work that Ted is doing for Gus's college fund?
Yeah, that's quite a jump to imbue onto the lesbians. It's one thing to be Emmett and think, huh, he suddenly has access to a whole bunch of money that he didn't have access to.
Right.
Because it's easy to let your gears start spinning.
Because they don't connect the dots
until
much later. But yeah, that's that was what I was trying to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Poor Emmett. The moment he heard that Ted stole that 5K and went to the white party, it's like all these clues that he was encountering just started to come together when he was realizing the truth.
Because,
that was tough.
Oh, because Emmett is very perceptive of what goes on in his community. So he can recognize a tweaker. He can recognize abusers very easily. And once he saw all the clues and he put that together, he knew exactly what it was.
Strangely, he didn't recognize it in Ted the week before when he came home from his lost weekend.
Yeah, with the sunglasses, right. And not quite knowing where he was.
So we got to kind of roll with the story a little bit here. Okay, so this episode, hits and misses. What's your hit?
My hit is something that we did not touch on, but it's in the Ted Runner. It is the fact that Vic and Rodney are still going strong.
Oh, yeah.
And they're playing strip Scrabble.
Is that a thing?
I think you can make anything a thing if you stripping is involved. So good for them.
My hit was Debbie lecturing Brian and getting stoned with him. I like these little Debbie backstories that we get from time to time when they're cliche, but she's lecturing somebody. Mm-hmm. So it's always fun to find out things like she was in an orgy at Woodstock with three guys named Julio.
Good for her.
Yeah, I like these little kind of Debbie things. It's like, I don't know if Debbie's old enough to have been there.
For all I know, she may not be telling the truth. She can be a bit of someone who tells tall tales. And totally. I'm into that.
What was your miss?
My miss is the tweaking doctor. I still don't quite get how he can function as a doctor. It seems that all he does is that party his ass off. So I would have loved to see the dynamic of him being tweaked and seeing patients.
We never do see him as doctor.
Yeah, so maybe this whole doctor thing is just absolute bullshit.
Yeah, maybe he's not a doctor. He's got a nice house, though, so he must be gainfully employed.
I think he's just a drug dealer.
Oh, interesting. It's too bad he wasn't at that party that Justin was at, that they didn't pick out one of those characters there. Would have been a great
maybe
tie-in.
We should go back and watch the episode and see if we can see him in the background.
My miss here, it felt a little improbable that Gardner and Stockwell would go surprise Brian at his loft at night. This revelation might have worked better if Stockwell and Gardner encountered Brian and Justin fucking on the copy machine at the office.
That's what I was waiting on. Absolutely.
You didn't have to leave the workplace. You didn't have to go to the workplace to begin with. But if you did, you might as well find them there versus leaving and then doing this improbable drive across town, getting past the front door of Brian's place up to the third floor to see him banging. It's like they both work in the same place. It's like, why not just bang in the office and get caught there?
Absolutely. Especially
as the copy machine's running off the posters of Stockwell.
Oh, perfect.
But not in this case.
Nope.
So this has been episode 11 of season 3, Poster May Lead to the Truth.
Next time, vowing to expose Stockwell, Brian investigates the murder of dumpster boy Jason Kemp.
Brian becomes a gumshoe.
Say.
And Melanie and Lindsay urge Emmett to stage an intervention on Ted's behalf. That will be episode 12 of season 3, and it's called Drugs, Sex, and Lies.
We're on Twitter at StillQueerAF, as well as Instagram. And you can find us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk. You can also leave us a message or write us a note at our website, StillQueerAsFolk.com/hello.
If you want to be my best friend, follow me on Instagram at Patrick Randall.
And I'm always looking for followers on Twitter and Instagram at Matthew PD.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed your time with us, please subscribe so that we can keep making these shows for you. So until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.